If I'd asked Laura if I was cured, she'd have said no, citing the statistics on anorexia. There was a good chance I'd relapse. The anorectic behavior would start again. I'd develop bradycardia and die of heart failure due to starvation. Or I'd die by suicide. Most likely, alcoholism was in my future. And that could lead to death, too. I'd have told her she was wrong. I wasn't Sarah the anorexic anymore. I ate the soups Chris made, heavy on olive oil and finished with butter. Indulged in one bowl, sometimes two, of ice cream in his presence, never in secret, and dined out on rich meals of fatty salmon and creamy mashed potatoes. It could all be indexed. A balanced diet, unrestricted calories, normal weight, no preoccupation with thinness, no scale in the house. I practically celebrated food with friends, mostly Chris's. I'd never needed a lot of friends. At our dinner parties, I ate apple pecan arugula salad, baked cod with sour cream and dill, and figs with chocolate for dessert. I could pay attention to the conversation and not count calories. The ratio of my healthy thoughts and actions to my unhealthy ones was 10 to 1, maybe 20 to 1. But the prevailing view is that most DSM diagnoses are chronic. People with them can experience relief. They can manage. They can even live a satisfying life. But they can't be cured. One afternoon on my way to work, I stopped at the used bookstore. M.F.K. Fisher's The Gastronomical Me stood on the shelf facing out. On the cover was a black and white photograph of Fisher wearing dark lipstick with her hair swept back in a bun, a chopstick holding it in place, exactly how I wore my hair. Fisher stared at the camera, bold, ready. I'd never heard of her and didn't know that she defined the American tradition of food writing as a mix of memoir, how-to guide, and adventure story. The book was a chronicle of her life as a woman with an unapologetically voracious appetite. I read the foreword. She wrote that food is one of our three basic needs, along with security and love. The three were so mixed and mingled and entwined that we cannot straightly think of one without the others. Her adoration of food was methodical and nostalgic. I flipped through the book, stopping to read her description of eating an oyster in all its slick, briny distinctiveness, her reflection on dining practices in ancient Egypt and the love of yogurt and honey among the ancient Greeks, and her remembrance of how she kept the wolf of hunger at bay amid rations and food shortages during World War II. That night, I sat with my coworkers at the bar folding napkins for the night service. Half of them were artists or aspiring actors who waited tables to pay their rent. Napkins folded, we polished the glasses and silverware and sampled the night's special, skate wing in a beurre blanc sauce. My favorite, rich, buttery, the fish flaky but moist. No flicker of panic passed through me as it melted onto my tongue. The restaurant was cool. With no street sign to indicate the entrance, you had to be in the know, which meant that annoyed and sometimes irate suburban patrons often arrived late for their reservations. There, food wasn't just eaten. It was studied. The chef had taught me the nuances among filet mignon, Chateaubriand steak, and beef Wellington. I learned the difference between a broth and consommé, crudité and charcuterie, a tart and a galette. Before service started, I stood by the kitchen window and chatted with one of the line cooks. Their shift started in the early afternoon, and after standing in front of a hot stove for 6 or 8 or 10 hours, ended whenever they'd broken down the kitchen for the night. And all for a fraction of what we made working a fraction of the time. Service for them was pressured and dangerous, given the sharpness of the knives and the extreme heat of the pans. The line cook hitched up the sleeve of his chef's coat. Burn marks striped his forearms. Food, I thought. He'd done that for the love of food. A foretop was seated in my section. I took their order, brought their wine, and opened it at the table. At the kitchen window, a server joked about a British couple who'd complained about their entrees the night before. Like they have any right to talk about food. What have they given the world? Shepherd's pie? I laughed. Then a sick feeling came over me. Heavy sick. Was the murky pit back? No, the skate wing must have been too rich. The sick feeling was soon accompanied by a burning sensation. It got worse. And worse. After half an hour, I went to my manager and asked to be cut. He hedged, worried it would get too busy. Eventually, he gave in. By the time I got home, the burning was intense. I kneeled between the toilet and tub and waited to throw up. The stomach aches that followed were different. The murky pit was replaced by bloating and nausea and fullness and burning pain. Not eating made it worse, not better. All I wanted was to eat. My thoughts of food were hopeful and desperate, but all I could stomach was steamed spinach or vegetable soup or dry toast. And often, not even those. In the late afternoons, the nausea and burning were accompanied by surges of a terrible energy that rushed through my chest and made me feel on edge. The edginess exhausted me, but my racing thoughts and pounding heart, which echoed in my ears, kept me up at night. I'd lie next to Chris and stare at the curtain blowing in the breeze coming through the open window. And then there were the migraines, which came with blinding auras that laid me out for hours at a time. A single dot on my field of vision would tendril out into flashes of light. I'd draw the shades and lie down in the bedroom. These headaches left me in a fog that made reading and writing seem impossible. Pregnancy was ruled out. I wasn't sent for a brain scan because I'd always had migraines, just not that blinding. My primary care physician sent me for a colonoscopy that showed my small and large intestines were fine. A barium swallow showed a possible ulcer, but not severe enough to cause the pain I described. Soon, I was regularly asking to be cut at work. Then I started to call in sick, something I never did. Finally, I asked my manager to schedule me for 2 shifts a week, which didn't help our finances. I spent a lot of time waiting for Chris to come home. One night, I pulled out the TV and turned to the public television channel. A black and white movie was on. I settled onto the couch. Cappy hopped up and nestled in my lap. It was a Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall movie I didn't catch the name of. In it, Bogart is accused of murder and gets plastic surgery to change his identity. In the scene when he removes the bandages to see his new face for the first time, he looks in the mirror and rubs his chin with concern. Bacall says she likes him better. He smiles. He has a new identity, a chance to be free. I thought I'd been given a new identity. I was finally rid of my appositive, my Ia. But now my freedom was being taken away. The colon that once introduced my good health, I was cured, colon, eating well, getting fresh air, exercising, now signaled a different set of symptoms. These problems were new, colon, burning stomach aches, depression, nervousness. Sometime later, while Chris worked the lunch shift, I went to our bookshelf. William Styron's Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness, wasn't a book I remembered buying. It must have belonged to Chris. The spine was barely creased and the pages crisp. I sat in our backyard in the sun and finished most of it in one sitting, getting sunburned in the process. My legs felt shaky as I stood. It was as if Styron was speaking directly to me. His depression didn't make him feel heavy and sleep all day. He had what his doctors called atypical depression, fine in the morning, buoyant even, only to be crushed by gloom and dread and anxiety in the late afternoon. I wanted to ask if he'd had a stomachache too. Styron gave me my first understanding of depression. He referred to it as a mood disorder, which sounded serious, and defined it as a biochemical malfunction that resulted from systemic stress amid neurotransmitters of the brain that caused the depletion of serotonin. It sounded so scientific, so reliable, so valid. It was the age of depression, but I didn't know that. The antidepressant Prozac had been around for nearly a decade and was grossing the pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly $2 billion annually. Elizabeth Wurtzel's depression memoir, Prozac Nation, was a bestseller. Styron mentions the DSM in passing, referring to it as the psychiatrist's Bible. I'd never heard of it. DSM? He said he studied it the way a medical student would to better understand his madness. Madness. In 1990, when Darkness Visible was published, Styron likely would have studied the DSM-3R, R for revision. From the way he describes his diagnosis, with certainty, he must have believed the DSM was a work of science. It's clear he wasn't aware of the damage done first by the DSM-3 and then by the 3R. The DSM-3 was headed by Columbia University professor of psychiatry Robert Spitzer. As task force leader, Spitzer, who's often referred to as one of the most influential psychiatrists in recent history, transformed our concept of mental disorders through the DSM. Journalist Alex Spiegel sums it up best. Spitzer took the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders and established it as a scientific instrument of enormous power. Spitzer and his co-authors created what looked like a scientific manual, one that would prove psychiatry's standing in medicine, even though many of its diagnoses were based on arbitrary categorizations. The DSM-3R, R for revision, was meant to repair inconsistencies in the DSM-3. But Spitzer ended up doing a repeat performance, reordering diagnostic categories and adding 25 more, increasing the DSM-1's 128 diagnoses and the DSM-2's 193 and the DSM-3's 228 to 253, based on no new empirical research. The DSM-3 could be seen as having twisted the definition of disease, itself a subject of ongoing debate, to make it fit the limited data they had. According to Tabor's Medical Dictionary, a disease requires not just complaints and symptoms, but laboratory or radiographic findings. A disease is objective, tangible, measurable. The DSM-3 offered no such findings, but still stated that its diagnoses were marked by signs and symptoms with an inference that there is a behavioral, psychological, or biological dysfunction. The word biological implied the manual's disorders were in some way objective. Although Spitzer said, there is no assumption that the organismic dysfunction or its negative consequences are of a physical nature, the DSM-3, as medical historian Edward Shorter writes, turned diagnoses into diseases. By the time Styron had the DSM in his hands, psychiatry was pushing the brain disease theory hard. In her influential 1984 book, The Broken Brain, psychiatrist and researcher Nancy Andreasen wrote, "The major psychiatric illnesses are diseases. They should be considered medical illnesses just as diabetes, heart disease, and cancer are. The emphasis in this model is on carefully diagnosing each specific illness from which the patient suffers, just as an internist or neurologist would." Others followed. Nobel laureate Eric Kandel, former NIMH director Thomas Insull, even the National Institutes of Health. Members of the psychiatric community argued over the definition of disease in an effort to make mental disorders fit it. Psychiatry has been trying to make DSM diagnoses into diseases for 30 years, but they haven't been able to, at least not without manipulating meanings and twisting definitions. Disorders like depression and anxiety aren't akin to cancer or diabetes. The comparisons don't hold up. Diseases like cancer and diabetes can be determined using an objective measure. DSM diagnoses were and are entirely subjective. They're based on self-reported symptoms and a clinician's opinion. I tend to be very thirsty, get hungry to the point of extreme irritability and dizziness, get tired, and urinate fairly frequently, TMI, I know, but I don't have diabetes. A blood test would show that. I could never just be told I have diabetes, identify as a diabetic, and start taking insulin. But if I walk into a psychiatrist's office and reveal that I've been known to worry, often can't control the worry, can feel restless and keyed up, often can't concentrate, get irritable, lie awake in the middle of the night, and often avoid social situations, I can be diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, and no objective measure can say otherwise. I'd likely walk out of that psychiatrist's office believing I have anxiety disorder, a mental illness, and may start psychotropic medication. DSM diagnoses weren't, and still aren't, valid. In clinical nosology, a diagnosis is valid if it exhibits essential properties. DSM diagnoses can't be reified, meaning they don't exist outside of someone observing them. They aren't even discrete disease entities, meaning they aren't clear-cut. Diagnoses and symptoms overlap. The hundreds of new diagnoses that appeared in the DSM-3 and 3R were essentially invented and ratified by committee. Spitzer and his co-authors attached symptoms to diagnoses and created diagnoses to fit symptoms. He supposedly had an unbridled enthusiasm for classifying. Something of a modern-day Linnaeus, Spitzer admitted, "Ever since I was a child, I liked to sort things." He's said to have delighted in clustering symptoms and arranging and rearranging them into theoretical bins to determine which best belonged with which diagnosis. Alan Francis, who edited the personality disorders section and led the DSM-4 task force, said the DSM-3's creation wasn't pretty to watch. It had the feel more of virtuoso performance art than scientific deliberation. Originally, the DSM didn't claim scientific authority. The APA published it to give hospital psychiatrists and clinicians a common language. That language primarily reflected the dominant theory of the age, psychodynamic and psychoanalytic psychiatry. The DSM-1, 1952, broadly distinguished among mental disorders. The symptom lists were vague, sometimes ending with "and so forth." Organic brain disorders, like epilepsy, were distinguished from those thought to be the result of external pressures, both psychotic, e.g. schizophrenia, and neurotic, e.g. anxiety and depression. It had little influence and wasn't thought of as a definitive nosology, meaning a medical, scientific classification of diseases. After the DSM-1, each edition tried to assert more scientific authority. The DSM-2, 1968, remained psychodynamic in orientation and expanded definitions of mental disorders to include milder conditions that affected more of the general public. With few exceptions, it removed the word reaction from its pages. No more depressive reaction or anxiety reaction or schizophrenic reaction. There was simply depression, anxiety, and schizophrenia. Although the DSM-2 stated that the removal of reaction didn't mean its diagnoses were fixed disease entities, its absence said that the causes of mental disorders, which couldn't be proven, didn't matter as much as the symptoms themselves. The paradigm had started to shift. The DSM-3, 1980, was a turning point. Since then, biological psychiatrists, researchers, drug companies, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, have wanted a diagnostic classification system that was, or seemed to be, based on hard science. The DSM-3R, 1987, maintained the DSM-3's declarations of scientific legitimacy. The DSM-4, 1994, introduced the idea that a diagnosis had to significantly impair the overall functioning of a person. What this meant was unclear because no biomarkers existed to define impairment and dysfunction. The DSM-4-TR 2000 introduced few changes. Even though neuroscience failed to prove definitively that DSM diagnoses had objective realities, the DSM-5, 2013, said, no, its diagnoses weren't biological, but just wait, not to worry, someday the neurocircuitry in the brain would likely, maybe, possibly show that they were. It seems convenient that psychiatry uses the terms illness and disease and disorder interchangeably, causing the rest of us and the media to do the same. We could argue that it doesn't matter. DSM diagnoses are disorders, as the title of the manual suggests. Without a test or physical indicator of what constitutes even just one DSM diagnosis, disorder is all psychiatry really has. But even that's shaky. As Jerome Wakefield writes, the claim of psychiatry to be a medical discipline depends on there being genuine mental disorders. The problem is that disorder is a value judgment. We can't say what makes a response to a life event disordered for every person in every situation. Even if we held to Wakefield's definition of disorder as harmful dysfunction, harmful is subjective. Psychiatry doesn't have its own definition of disorder. Often it relies on terms like distress and disability, but those two are relative. If, as the DSM authors admit, a disorder can't be defined, and the task forces and committees that write the DSM don't have a way to quantify disorder, what are we being diagnosed with? Styron wouldn't have asked this question as he sat at his desk with a light shining down on the pages of the DSM, him taking it in as science, as truth. During a trip to New York, my symptoms were at their worst. The carpeting of our cheap Midtown hotel room was so dingy and threadbare as to be barely beige. The windows looked out onto a brick wall. The sounds of traffic, cars screeching, ambulance and police sirens wailing, horns honking, must have come from the street, but we didn't hear them, not over the din of the window air conditioner's battered fan. The room smelled of the mildewy shower. I should remember the color of the bedspread, should remember more about the hotel room, because I spent a lot of time in it alone. Mainly, I read while Chris visited friends and went out to eat. My stomach burned and ached. Each afternoon came the crushing dread and terrible surging energy. As we packed to go home, me on the bed, him putting his clothes in our suitcase, I said I didn't feel well. "I know," he said, more irritated than I'd ever heard him. "I know you don't feel well." I expected this to be followed with something along the lines of, "I've had enough," or "I can't take it." He stopped and reached out his arms to me. As I went to him, I wanted so much to be well and not be the person I was. He held me, my head against his chest, and stroked my hair. The afternoon I had my first suicidal ideation, I sat on our couch with Cappy snuggled in the crook of my arm. Chris was out. Light raindrops ticked against the window behind me. The stomach aches, now acidic with seizures of nausea, continued. Reading became increasingly difficult, so I started to reread Fisher's books. That afternoon, my eyes drifted over her words, barely taking them in. It's hard to say if the thought or the image came first. The thought must have. This is never going to end. Then came the image, the bathroom, the tub, our clawfoot tub, my body inside the tub, my wrists slit, the bathwater red. The image stayed too long. I nudged Cappy onto the couch and stood. I paced. It flashed through my mind, again and again, almost in sync with the rain against the window. Sitting on the edge of a chair at the kitchen table, I started to panic. Was I suicidal? What did suicidal even mean? Most of what I knew came from movies, pop culture, and the media. Celebrities had died that way. Ernest Hemingway, Marilyn Monroe, Sylvia Plath, Virginia Woolf, Kurt Cobain. I'd heard most about Cobain, who'd died a few years earlier and whose death was almost always described as tragic. Researchers and clinicians still presumed suicidal behavior was a symptom of mood disorders like major depressive disorder, MDD, or borderline personality disorder, BPD. Suicidal behavior disorder hadn't yet been considered a distinct condition. Not that I would have been aware of that. Depression and the DSM and psychiatry and suicide weren't part of my life. I had one friend who took medication, but we'd never really talked about it. Back then, mental health wasn't a buzzword. When Chris came home, he made us dinner. Tomato, fennel, white bean soup, and a baguette. I thought of Fisher, who wrote that to nourish oneself demands honesty. There is food in the bowl, and more often than not, because of what honesty I have, there is nourishment in the heart to feed the wilder, more insistent hungers. Honesty was a precursor to satiety. Without being honest with ourselves and with others, we have no hope of feeling full. After he ate and cleaned up, I sat on the couch. He went into the dining room to practice guitar. Each plunk of the country blues song he played, Robert Johnson and Blind Willie McTell, told me to say it. Go in the dining room and sit next to him. I just imagined my death. Or go into my writing room and try to explain it in a letter. Dear Chris, I may be suicidal. I went to bed and lay there, staring up at the ceiling, unable to understand it myself. When I first read Darkness Visible, I didn't notice how Styron uses colons to introduce and signal what's to come. As a writer, I was ashamed of my ignorance of punctuation's rules and meaning, but it still meant little to me. My How to Write Fiction and How to Write Poetry books never mentioned it. The colon explains his depression. Its most famous and sinister hallmarks, colon, confusion, failure of mental focus, and lapse of memory. and how, for him, it came on late in the day. There was now something that resembled bifurcation of mood, lucidity of sorts in the early hours of the day, gathering murk in the afternoon and evening. He uses it to introduce a quote from Camus' famous essay on suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. The colon offers a miserable prognosis for the depressive who has suicidal thoughts. The argument I put forth was fairly straightforward, The pain of severe depression is quite unimaginable to those who have not suffered it, and it kills in many instances because its anguish can no longer be borne. And lists the many fallen artists who've succumbed to suicide. Hart Crane, Vincent van Gogh, Virginia Woolf, Arshil Gorky, Cesare Pavese, Romain Gary, Vaka Lindsay, Sylvia Plath, Henri de Montherlant, Mark Rothko, John Berryman, Jack London, Ernest Hemingway, William Inge, Deanne Arbus, Tadeusz Borowski, Paul Celan, Anne Sexton, Sergei Yesenin, Vladimir Mayakovsky. The list goes on. Colons don't appear in the strange, ethereal short stories I wrote then. Not knowing how to use them, I just pretended they didn't exist. Never mind the lists and descriptions I could have introduced, the explanations I could have provided, the words I may have defined, the people I might have quoted. The colon is a holy punctuation mark. Like the comma, it came to us via Aristophanes of Byzantium's three-dot system, but it was put to use in 400 AD when the priest Saint Jerome used it to mark off sections of the Vulgate Bible to be sure monks read the Word of God correctly. The colon told the monks to pause longer than the middle dot, but not quite as long as the high one. Pacing. Proper reverence for the words they spoke. It doesn't pace or join or separate or end. It prophesizes. Derived from the Greek word for limb, it signals an extension. It appears after a clause, a complete thought. I wanted only two things, to be with Chris and to write. Like two headlights, it shines a light on what's to come, lists. Maybe I could have done more to make myself well, rested, eaten better, exercised, and information. Suicidal thoughts are only cause for alarm in one instance, when passive thoughts become active thoughts. I forced myself back to work. One night, I stood at the bar and ordered a bottle of wine for a table. Service had started when the burning in my stomach flared. The weight of dread descended. The terrible surging energy rose in me. They met in the middle of my chest. The bartender came back and set the bottle of Pinot Noir on the cocktail tray. He asked, "Are you okay?" I didn't answer. At the host station, my manager stood talking to a couple who had eaten in my section. Although their voices were calm and easy, they seemed to crack against my chest. When the couple finally left, I told my manager I had to leave. His look said, "Are you kidding?" I brought my hand to my forehead. As I did, he stared at it. It was shaking. I got home to a dark, empty apartment. Still shaking, I sat on the couch, the phone in my hand. Fear, unreasonable and paralyzing, rose in me. On the couch, I stared at the bathtub. A string of thoughts followed. This is never going to end. It will never get better. It will only get worse. I can't take this. No image came. The thought seemed fleeting, just sentences in my mind. Nothing serious. When Chris got home, I was in bed. Again, I stared at the ceiling. The sound of him opening the fridge reached me. A moment later came the clink of a bottle on the counter, a drawer opening and closing, the fizz of the cap being pried off the bottle, the tap of the cap on the counter. I pictured him going into the living room. Eventually, he'd sit on the couch, headphones on, and listen to music. I wish I could say I got out of bed and that Chris was on the couch, and that it took a minute for him to look up, and when he did, I knew I could tell him everything, and that I did, that I told him about the image and the thoughts, and that he looked alarmed, and because he rarely looked alarmed, his alarm alarmed me, and he reached out and drew me to him, and I rested my head on his chest. More than anything, I wish I could say he looked in my eyes and asked what we should do, and that the we, his inclusion of himself in the situation, my situation, brought a rush of relief because I wasn't alone. But I don't remember telling him. I remember wondering what the image and the thoughts meant about me. I remember being scared. I remember wanting to tell him. I remember, at some point, the two of us perched on the edge of the couch, him facing me, his knees touching mine. 3. Suspension points. The next year and a half is riddled with gaps, ellipses. Ellipsis marks, the dot, dot, dot of punctuation, are all about erasing, forgetting, denying. The word ellipsis comes from the Greek, meaning to fall short or to leave out. Omissions, blackouts, lapses of memory. We had dinner, drank a bottle of wine, talked about our relationship, ordered another bottle, and then dot, dot, dot. The failure to recall. Unlike other punctuation marks that clarify, the ellipsis instills doubt. It marks the inability to finish a thought, a aposiopesis. I drank a lot, but I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic or dot, dot, dot. It's a mark of hesitation. Had Chris tried to talk to me about my drinking but held back? Had he stopped out of a wish not to upset me? Sarah, you really need to dot, dot, dot. Never mind. Ellipses can signal a lack of self-confidence. I was dot, 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 doing well. Ellipsis points, as we know them, date back to the 16th century, but didn't come widely into use until the 17th and 18th centuries. Often they appeared not as three dots, but as multiple hyphens, dashes, or asterisks. One of the earliest recorded uses of ellipses appears in the 1588 edition of the English translation of Roman dramatist Terence's Andrea. The translator used multiple hyphens to tell the actor when a character trailed off or was interrupted. Sometimes called suspension points, ellipses can be addicting. People have been trying to prevent their overuse since the 18th century. Once you start to use them to denote a falling off, an absence, or a dramatic pause, well, dot, 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 it's hard to stop. It's teasing how they imply more is to come. There was no way of knowing what would happen next. Dot, dot, dot. Seattle wasn't what we expected. We'd moved after visiting the city on a misleadingly sunny weekend. The Puget Sound had glistened in the sunlight, and Mount Rainier stood majestic in the distance. The city seemed to us a bastion of musicians and writers. We'd gone to the Tractor Tavern in Ballard to see a band. While walking down the street in First Hill, checking out possible neighborhoods, we'd passed a woman wearing pajamas and a bathrobe sitting on her front stoop reading. Everyone, it seemed, played music. Everyone, it seemed, read. We were wrong. Amazon was on the rise, bringing with it not books and readers, but exorbitant rents and dot-commers. We lived in a tiny two-room apartment, so different from our place in Chicago. The grunge phenomenon, thanks to Sub Pop Records and Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, had drawn many, too many, aspiring musicians. And Chris wasn't having luck booking gigs. He'd left the service industry and was a baker in a small cafe. I'd become a sommelier and had little time to write. At least no suicidal images or thoughts had followed me there. I'd interviewed for a position as a part-time writing tutor at one of Seattle's community colleges, but hadn't heard. During my interview, the director of the center had been welcoming. She was one of those women you'd describe as sharp, but with kind eyes behind her glasses. The writing center seemed heavenly. Extra pens and scrap paper were on all the tables. The fall term hadn't started, and no students were there, but it had the same mentally nourishing energy found in libraries. It smelled of the grammar books that lined the shelves. I pulled out my laptop and sat at the kitchen table to check my email. I'd had to take a grammar and punctuation proficiency test. As soon as I sat down, the director put the paper in front of me, and my hangover kicked in. I hadn't intended to drink the night before, but Chris and I split a bottle of wine and then a second bottle. It had seemed harmless enough. The two of us at our kitchen table, Cappy on the window ledge, soaking in the rays of a rare Seattle sunset. But at the writing center, as I tried to fill in sentences with the correct punctuation, my mind turned foggy. I want the job, but, comma, my grammar and punctuation skills might not be strong enough. Cappy hopped on my lap. On my laptop were two emails. I opened the one from the director. I'm happy to inform you, ... The first meeting was in 2 days. This was it. New job, new life. I'd drink less. I couldn't tutor hungover and foggy. I'd get back to writing. That afternoon, I went to work. As I closed the restaurant door behind me, the sound echoed against the dining room's white walls and 20-foot ceilings. The waitstaff wouldn't be in for hours. On the other side of the frosted glass wall that separated the front of the house from the kitchen, the sous chef and line cooks prepped for the night service. The tables in the dining room were bare except for the white tablecloths. No meetings with purveyors were scheduled for that afternoon. I had a study session for my master sommelier exam that would be held in Las Vegas in a couple of weeks. I was an accidental sommelier. I'd been waiting tables at the restaurant when they fired the first sommelier for stealing. I was very good at distinguishing between the earthiness of a French Pinot Noir from the dense berry fruit of one from the Willamette Valley. They asked me to fill the position. Wine excited and interested me in a geeky, knowing information no one else cares about way. One wine might smell so much like the earth that you could practically feel the dirt between your fingers. Another would have such a velvety finish, you felt as though you were eating the richest dark chocolate. Another would pop with raspberry, like it came from the actual fruit. Working in restaurants had been a way to earn money to write. Suddenly, I spent all my time and energy on wine. I was getting media attention because I was young and a woman in a male-dominated industry, and Pacific Northwest wines were it. I was quoted in Wine Spectator and featured in Fortune. Chris and I noted the irony, given my meager salary. It seemed right to register for the Master's Sommelier exam. My bosses were excited. There seemed no way to quit and back out. At a table near the window, looking out on the street, I placed several wine glasses in front of each of three chairs. I put down a wine bucket to be used as a spittoon. Today, from now on, I'd use it. There was no need to swallow, ever. A wine's appearance in the glass told a real sommelier what she needed to know. Its aroma revealed 80% of the information. One sip, a few swishes in the mouth, and a spit were enough to gauge the balance. Alcohol, acidity, tannin, and fruit. Intensity, its body, and finish, the taste that lingers. There came a knock on the restaurant door. The two other sommeliers in my study group arrived. We weren't officially sommeliers and should have been called wine directors, but everyone used the title casually back then. They'd already completed the 2-day intensive and written theory portion of the introductory exam and were prepping for the advanced. I was on stage one. We sat. They uncorked the wines they'd brought, all in wine sleeves to hide the labels. I half listened as they gossiped about other restaurants and discussed the wines they'd added to their lists. I pulled out my notebook and a pen to take notes during the tasting. They already had theirs out. We raised the first glass of red and searched for signs of visible sediment, analyzed its concentration, pale, medium, deep, noted its primary colors, purple, ruby, garnet, and secondary colors, orange tinge or blue, and assessed its staining and tearing, its legs, which indicate the alcohol content. I enjoyed the detective work of guessing a wine. I swirled my glass to release the wine's aroma. Jammy fruit, new wood, spice, a hint of earthiness. Easy, American, Cabernet, or a blend. I smelled it again. Napa, or Sonoma. Maybe early 1990s. Sip. Swish. Spit, I told myself as I swallowed. The buzz of the first sip was always the best. A warm feeling in my belly. A cascade of relief after it was absorbed in my stomach lining and seeped into my bloodstream and spread, eventually blocking the signals between my brain cells, giving me a kind of chemical serenity that stilled my thoughts. One of my cohorts reached for the wine bucket, brought it close, and spit. I took another sip of my wine. And another. Alcoholism has been described as a sign of insanity, a moral failing, a social problem, and a disease. During the 18th century, psychiatrists referred to alcoholism as oinomania, wine mania. It could be acute, periodic, or chronic. An alcoholic was seen as exhibiting temporary insanity and was often treated in an asylum. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, the temperance movement argued that alcoholism was more of a social problem than one that affected individuals. After World War II, it was categorized as an addiction and a biological disease. The DSM has primarily generated confusion in its classification of alcoholism as a mental disorder. The DSM authors seem unable to decide if alcoholism should be classified as one disorder or two. Alcoholism appeared in the DSM-1 as a sociopathic personality disturbance. Imagine saying that at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm sociopathically disturbed. In the DSM-2, it was classified as a non-psychotic personality disorder. The DSM-3 no longer used the term alcoholism and referred to it as substance use disorder, which was divided into two subtypes, substance abuse and substance dependence. What was the difference? Few could say. Some speculate that abuse referred to drinking problems that incurred negative social, legal, or occupational consequences, and dependence meant withdrawal. But the DSM-3 wasn't clear. The split remained in the DSM-3R and the DSM-4. The DSM-5 combined abuse and dependence into the broadly defined and easy to be diagnosed with substance-related and addictive disorders. At the time, I only needed one of the following symptoms to qualify for a substance abuse disorder: a failure to fulfill major work obligations, not yet, interpersonal problems, check, drinking in dangerous situations, check, substance-related legal problems, not yet. A substance dependence disorder required only three of the following: tolerance, check, withdrawal, check, larger amounts taken of a longer period than intended, double check, persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to stop, check, a great deal of time spent to get, use, or recover from alcohol, drinking was my job, activities no longer participated in, check, continued drinking despite knowing there's a problem, absolutely. I would have aced the test. Yes, I drank fast and plenty, and it hit me hard. But either no one noticed or they did but didn't care. Yes, I blacked out, but I didn't take nips of alcohol first thing in the morning. Yes, alcoholism ran in families and it ran in mine, but I wasn't an alcoholic and could stop any time. When I got home from work the night before my first day at the writing center, Chris was already asleep. He had to be up at 4 a.m. to make it to the bakery. Cappy brushed against my legs and let out a meow. I brought my finger to my lips. Shh. She let out another, louder, meow. Not a drop. All I had to do was hang up my coat, put down my bag, go into the bathroom, turn on the light, and start getting ready for bed. The rest seemed to come from someone else. The kitchen. A wine glass. The bottle of red on the counter. As I uncorked it, I paused, picturing myself in the writing center, a student asking me to look over his essay, my eyes scanning the page, hitting on commas and letters and periods, and not being able to tell him if it was correct. The rules. I didn't know the rules. One glass turned into two, then three. As I drank, my thoughts looped. The writing center, wines to order, sommelier study group, commas. I went to the bookshelf. My legs felt heavy. I scanned the spines for a grammar book I knew was there but couldn't find. Back at the table, I lifted my still half-full glass to my lips. It was simple. Pour it down the sink. I stood and went to the kitchen. Just one more sip. And another. And my lips drew tight. Drunk. I was drunk. It had happened before. Many times, and had been happening more often. I tried to smile, but couldn't. A kind of paralysis spread to my arms and legs. I pitched forward and leaned against the counter and... The next morning, the alarm went off and I showered. Chris had long since been at work. I didn't remember changing and getting into bed. In the kitchen, my wine glass was washed and in the dish rack already dry. The bottle I'd finished was rinsed and in the recycling bin. The bike ride down the hill was a rush. I was still drunk. Downtown, I locked up my bike to a rack and waited for the bus. The man next to me smelled of alcohol. No, I smelled of alcohol. On the bus to North Seattle, I ate the bagel I'd made. It sopped up whatever alcohol, if any, was left in my stomach. Half an hour later, my head started to pound. I made it to the writing center 5 minutes late. The other tutors were seated at the various tables listening attentively to the director. I slipped in and sat in the back. No one would notice. I'd covered the smell of alcohol by chewing peppermint gum and dabbing lavender oil on my wrists. As the director spoke, an older woman with short, graying hair interrupted her twice. It would have been annoying, except everything the woman said about the semester's assignments and how best to work with students was helpful. The director finished and introduced the woman as Evelyn, who would be leading a professional development mini-lesson. Evelyn stood up and used a sandwich board to outline her main points. Nominative case, objective case, possessive case, case in opposition, nominative of address. I nodded at what she said but had no idea what she was talking about. Cases were way out of my league. Around me, the others nodded too. I wondered if theirs were truthful. That afternoon at home, I went to the bookshelf and pulled out the grammar book. It felt heavy in my hands. I'd study. At the next meeting, I'd nod for real. My wine glass was still on the dish rack. Seated at the table, I read case, number, person. A dot flashed in the corner of my right eye. I went to the bathroom. My migraine pills weren't in the medicine cabinet. I searched my bag. Finding them, I popped one in my mouth and swallowed it with water. My migraines called for a dark room. I closed the blinds in the bedroom and lay on the bed. The light show started. A firework display of white light started as a dot and grew, dot by dot, until my vision was impeded and I couldn't move. My hands started to tingle, then my face. The flashing light grew larger. The pain started in the top right of my skull, a concentrated, leaden pain. I thought, brain hemorrhage. My breathing grew shallow and merged with a sharp pain in my chest. I wanted to call Chris, call an ambulance, but I couldn't see. So I lay there, monitoring the pain in my heart and the frequency of the flashes of light. Cappy hopped onto the bed, startling me. She walked across my stomach, nuzzled in the crook of my neck, and purred. I woke to the sound of Chris coming in the door. The aura was gone. He sat on the edge of the bed and asked if I was okay. I said I'd had a migraine and clutched my chest. I think something's wrong with my heart. He smiled, though not unkindly. I think maybe you just had too much to drink last night. An hour later, we sat on the blue plastic chairs of the emergency waiting room. I'd insisted on going. I was dying. I had to be dying. The words chest pain should have gotten me in right away, but my blood pressure and oxygen levels and temperature must have told them that whatever was wrong with me, it wasn't urgent. My symptoms weren't severe enough to warrant immediate care. An attendant called my name. We followed him and then a nurse to the triage area. I put on a hospital gown. Chris held both our coats in his arms. He leaned against the wall, his head back. I sat on the gurney. The metal was cool against my leg. The thin white paper crumpled beneath me. The doctor pulled back the curtain and said a confident hello. Chris said he'd wait outside and left, cradling both our coats. The doctor studied my intake forms. He shined a light into my eyes, looked inside my mouth, and peered inside each of my ears. I lay down. He pressed on my belly, asking if it hurt. I said no. He told me to sit up. As he pressed the glands of my neck and pressed his stethoscope to my chest, I told him I'd had a migraine, and my heart had felt as though it was being squeezed through a sieve. It was like I was having a heart attack. He raised his eyebrows and said that as a 27-year-old woman with no history of heart trouble in her family, I likely wasn't having a heart attack. Are you experiencing more stress in your life? I said, not really. although with my new job and Seattle not being what we'd hoped and feeling, well, hungover most of the time, I guess I was. He picked up my forms and wrote something I couldn't see. "Because," he said, still writing, "stress can cause somatic symptoms." Somatic symptoms. Psychosomatic. Psycho. He slipped his pen into the pocket of his white coat. They did an EKG. The doctor returned. Normal. The pain. The same pain from that morning pierced my heart. I asked if he thought we should do some more tests. "You may want to consider talking to someone to help with any stress you may be feeling." "What if it's not just stress?" The doctor nodded curtly. "I'm pretty sure it's stress." I dressed and went to Chris, kissed him, and told him what the doctor said. He shook his head dismayed, as if to say, "See? Nothing's wrong with you." Malingerer. Someone who purposely feigns or exaggerates illness for profit. The malingerer pretends to be sick to get out of work, military service, jury duty, a party. Or for disability, workers' comp, sympathy, care, attention. The malingerer is an opportunist who lies about the most important thing we have, our health. But my heart pains were real, and the headaches, and the ringing in my ears, and the adrenaline rushes, and hypochondriac, maybe. The hypochondriac produces bodily suffering where there is none. She either avoids doctors or compulsively seeks help from them, often getting second and third opinions, only to end up as unconvinced of her health as when she started. She's a burden, sapping the energies of family and friends, using up taxpayer money, and draining medical resources. Hypochondria was once treated as a physical illness, but eventually was thought of as a mental disorder that manifests in physical symptoms. The word's very etymology is bodily. Hypochondria. Hypo meaning under and chondria meaning cartilage, refers to the soft part of the sternum between the ribs and the navel. Early physicians believed hypochondriacal symptoms were caused by a buildup of black bile in the stomach. By the 17th century, hypochondria was considered the result of disordered thinking projected onto the body. During the 18th century, physicians classified it as a nervous reaction that resulted from privilege and weak nerves. It was most often diagnosed in wealthy, educated men. During the DSM era, hypochondria continued to be categorized as a psychosomatic illness. The DSM-1 described hypochondriacal neurosis in Freudian terms as a neurotic condition that resulted from unconscious conflicts. The DSM-3 referred to it as hypochondriasis. The DSM-4 classified it under somatoform body disorders. The DSM-5 subsumed it under somatic symptom, or illness anxiety disorder. Today, hypochondria is considered long-term and debilitating. The hypochondriac takes each pain as a sign of a deadly illness and rejects reassurance from healthcare professionals. She self-diagnoses with disease after disease. Her physical symptoms have no detectable cause. If I'd seen a psychiatrist, I probably wouldn't have been diagnosed with hypochondriasis. It wasn't a popular DSM diagnosis at the time. Possibly, that psychiatrist would have filed me under generalized anxiety disorder, or a personality disorder, or placed me on the obsessive-compulsive disorder spectrum. If I'd seen a psychologist, she would have asked me to talk through the underlying trauma, I had none, or stress, I had relatively little, behind my hypochondria. If trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, she might have shown me how to break down my thoughts, question my assumptions, and recognize the way I jumped to conclusions, catastrophizing every ache and pain. But I didn't see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Instead, I drank. The night before my first day of tutoring, I vowed not to drink. It went as well as you might expect. A glass of wine. And then another. And when I arrived at the center, the director gave me another tour. She showed me the forms to fill out for each student. Evelyn entered and sat at one of the tables. From her bag, she pulled her own reference books. The shelves were lined with many to choose from, and red pens, a glasses case, and a coffee thermos. The director asked if I had any questions. I shook my head and sat at the table farthest from Evelyn. My stomach growled. It felt raw. My mind was so foggy that it seemed impossible to tutor anyone in anything. I got up and gathered my own stack of reference books from the bookshelf. As I passed Evelyn's table, she slipped on a pair of horn-rimmed glasses and introduced herself. She was a retired writing and rhetoric professor and had been working at the center for fun since she'd retired. The door to the center opened and the first student walked in. My head started to pound. I sat at my table and tried to look busy. He headed toward Evelyn. Before he sat down, Evelyn turned to me. Would you? Oh, no. I made it sound as if I were doing her a favor. That's okay. You take him. Evelyn took all three students who came in that morning. During my half-hour lunch break, I sat on a concrete bench and ate the egg salad sandwich I'd brought. The campus was crowded with students. The sandwich made my stomach feel better, but did nothing to clear my head. When I returned, Evelyn stood. A sense of panic came over me. Where are you? She smiled. Lunch. A student walked in. He beelined in my direction. That same pain pierced my heart. He sat across from me and pulled out the paper he was working on. Evelyn passed our table. Another pain, this time in my side. Deep. My liver, pancreas, spleen. Something was wrong. Really wrong. I asked the student's name. He told me. My stomach seized. I asked what he needed help with. He hesitated. I waited. He pulled out an assignment sheet and handed it to me. Brainstorm on a topic for... Relief flooded me. He needed to brainstorm an essay. That I could do. Alcoholism has most recently been accepted as a disease, particularly in recovery communities like AA, which tells its members it's chronic and that they're powerless over it. Despite this, AA co-founder Bill Wilson didn't actually consider it a disease entity, though he was willing to call it an illness. As far as the science goes, Wilson was right. It has no known biological cause. Many consider it to be a mix of personality, sociopathy, genetics, socioeconomics, and, a very loaded assumption, ethnicity. People are as likely to recover through clinical intervention as without it. The mind neurosis, brain disease dilemma has troubled psychiatry since the late 19th century. Two major figures epitomize the dichotomy: Emil Kraepelin and, of course, Freud. Kraepelin is often referred to as the father of biological psychiatry, though at the time, biological meant autopsying brain matter as neurotransmitters hadn't yet been discovered. Freud, the father of psychoanalysis. Kraepelin investigated the brain. Freud theorized the mind. Kraepelin believed mental illnesses were caused by external factors and biology. Freud, that they were triggered by childhood trauma, psychic conflict, and sexual fantasies. Kraepelin tended those with serious mental illnesses in asylums. Freud listened to the worried well in the city. Kraepelin focused on the course and prognosis of mental disorders. Freud hunted for their hidden causes. Kraepelin classified. Freud generalized, often based on reflections about himself and maybe one or two patients. Psychiatric philosophy and practice has moved between these two theories and approaches. During the late 19th century, the brain was thought to hold the answers to what was referred to as insanity and idiocy. Psychiatrists, nearly all of whom treated the most severely ill in asylums, were often more interested in conducting autopsies than treating patients. The 1880 census defined seven types of mental illness. Three divided the agitated violent from the depressed nonviolent. The other four were paralysis, dementia, alcoholism, and epilepsy. Then psychiatry changed. During the first part of the 20th century, Freudian ideology and methods dominated clinical practice and universities. Like Freud, many psychiatrists went to cities and towns to treat the upper classes with mild complaints. Freud was something of a snob. He would only see patients of a certain education, class, and age, and refused to see psychotic patients, adolescents, and anyone older than 50 on the grounds that they would not be properly receptive to psychoanalysis. The general population, he once wrote in a letter, was trash. Psychoanalytic theories of the neurotic mind became the vogue, like those in Freud's 1901 treatise, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, which turned simple acts like forgetting a name or saying the wrong word into evidence of unconscious desires and repressed memories. Of the two manuals that predated the DSM, the Statistical Manual for the Use of Institutions for the Insane favored a biological explanation, whereas the War Department Technical Bulletin, Medical 203, relied primarily on a neurosis-based one. In 1918, the American Medico-Psychological Association, later renamed the American Psychiatric Association, compiled the Statistical Manual to obtain data about who received care in mental hospitals and asylums. It was used by hospitals for record keeping, but not widely beyond that. This was due in part to the fact that the powerful psychobiologist Adolf Meyer, psychiatrist in chief at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, didn't approve. Meyer believed mental illnesses were caused by a combination of biology and reactions to life circumstances that presented as illnesses. Chalk him up as one of psychiatry's many controversial figures. He was involved in the eugenics movement and supported a treatment that removed, one by one, the infected organs of people with schizophrenia. The Statistical Manual outlined 21 diagnoses. 20 applied to those with psychosis with an assumed biological basis, and just one to those without psychosis, neurosis. It was the dominant classification system used until the early 1940s. In 1946, a group of mental health professionals under the auspices of the U.S. Army published Medical